So we see here is they have a capacity or they have a potency. So in this case, then we would see that potency, that would be the aspect of Krishna. And then the form of the word and the grammatical order that you put it in, that would be Lakshmi's form. You understand? That would be the aspect representation of Lakshmi. Yes? Because then you have the Lord and then his energies that establish the form that then serves that point. So therefore, depending upon, you want to make a point. So then that is a particular potency. You have to have the right word that expresses that. Right? That's why even you have a correct word and then within the words you have synonyms. So it may be the correct general concept, but it's not specific enough. So you use the particular word that actually means. Then how you order it in the sentence can also have meaning, what becomes more prominent, what not, what exactly you want to mean and all that. That's why then the whole concept of vocabulary and grammar becomes important. Because right? Vocabulary, you actually have the words that you can use. And the grammar, you know how to put those words together so you can actually express what you want to express. Yes? Yeah? Okay, I think some of these things can be used in your Akanksha, which is expectancy. The first condition means expectancy. Akanksha is the quality by which all the words of a sentence imply or expect one another. It is the need that each word has for the other words in that sentence. According to the Nyaya system, a word is not in itself capable of conveying a complete meaning. It must be brought into relationship with other words in order to express the full meaning intended. For example, when someone hears the word bring, he asks or he thinks about what to bring. It could be a jar, a book, a pencil, a donut, or anything else. Thus, expectancy is the interdependence of the words in a sentence for expressing a complete meaning. What do you think? So you'd go for the donut, right? Or even better, a jar full of donuts? Okay. So in other words, all the words, they have relationship to everything else. Just having one thing, that is fine, but it doesn't establish the relationship. Right? So we see even Krishna, he is one, but he expands into many for relationship. Does that make sense? So therefore, one doesn't give the actual, meaning, because that meaning is going beyond, there some action is involved, something there. If it's going to be a sentence, a clause, there has to be a verb. They're all centered around the verb. That means there is a relationship between two things, right? There'll always be a subject and an object. You'll have one thing and it's related to the other through the action. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, also in that, just according to what we were studying in this Nyaya, then what would be similar to formula? Anybody? You have the minor, the major, and the middle, right? So the middle is what's connecting the minor and the major, right? So the subject and the object is connected by the verb. You understand? So the verb, if it's properly connected to the object and is properly connected to the subject, that means then the subject and the object are connected. Right? So we see that's what the beauty of the Vedic system is, that everything works by the same process. Right? Does that make sense? It's always going to work that way. No? You have yourself, you have a doctor, you have medicine. Right? So the doctor knows the medicine, the doctor knows your disease, he can connect you to the medicine. Does that make sense? So it works everywhere. That's the beauty of the system. So to consider that it's an archaic system or doesn't apply now, just because the individual who's making that statement doesn't actually understand what he's talking about, that doesn't actually make it fact. You know what I'm saying? You know, there are people who do not know very much, not very sophisticated. They don't know how things work in the world. It doesn't mean the world doesn't go on. Does that make sense? So that's all I'm saying. Okay, so in other words, the relationship between the words, what one word is, you know, expects from another word. In other words, each one has a need for the other. Yogyata, the second condition, means fitness, right? It refers to the appropriateness of the words in a sentence, to the absence of contradiction in its terms. For example, sentences like "moisten with fire" or "he is frustrated because of his inner peace" make no sense because there is a contradiction between fire and moistening, between frustration and peace. Fire has no ability to moisten anything, and inner peace cannot engender frustration. Therefore, although these sentences may be grammatically correct, they do not express valid knowledge. Right? So in other words, the words have to belong there. Otherwise, they don't necessarily mean anything like that. Yes? Sannidhi. The third condition means proximity. It is very important for words to be used within the limits of an appropriate time and space. If the duration of their use is prolonged, then words no longer have the capacity to give the desired meaning. For example, if someone who desires to make a statement speaks one word today, another word tomorrow, and the third word the day after, his efforts at effective communication are certain to fail. Right? The same holds true for the written word. If someone writes one word on page 1, another on page 3, one more on page 5, another on page 10, then his meaning will not be communicated effectively. Continuity of time and space is therefore essential for a sentence to convey the meaning. Okay? Right? Unless you put it up in the very top right-hand corner, and then you flip the pages, then maybe it'll have some meaning. Otherwise, then it won't. Okay. Tatparya, the fourth condition, means intention, and it refers to the meaning one intends a sentence to convey. A word may have various meanings depending on its context. So one has to be careful to determine the real intention of the person who uses the word. This is also the case with scriptural testimony. Even the greatest scholars have disagreements concerning some passages because they do not understand the original intention of those sentences. That's why much of the time it's mentioned that if you study a shastra, then you have to read the whole thing. You can't just go in and pick and choose something because you may not understand the intention for which it was made. Right? Just like in Manu, he's talking about the aspect of animal sacrifice. Right? And in there, he's discussing how that the animal being sacrificed, because it's done according to the Vedic terms and all that, is not sin. Right? And then he's going on about how this is nonviolence, all these different things. But, so you could take it that Manu is supportive of animal sacrifice. But if you read the full text, you get the context that actually he doesn't. In other words, he's saying it's not sinful if it's done properly according to the Vedic directions, but there will be reaction. Right? So, therefore, then if you consider it, why would you want to be involved in that? Any intelligent man wouldn't want to be involved in that reaction. Therefore, better you're a vegetarian. You understand? But if you don't take the whole thing, you'll miss the context. So that's why there'll be disagreements. Someone only takes part of what's there. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. Yes?
So this is what I was going to say, that Prabhupada said this and that.
Yes, some say Prabhupada said this, some say that. So they're taking the words sometimes literally in a context how they would possibly use them. But then if you understand the context, what is being... it's being presented in, then you wouldn't necessarily come up with that idea. Right? Does that make sense? You have a different idea. A very simple illustration is this. Suppose someone tells you to bring him a bat. You have no way of knowing whether you are being asked to provide a particular type of flying mammal or a wooden club. Right? To understand the real intention of a sentence, one has to comprehend accurately the context in which the words are used. Because of the unique nature of the Sanskrit language and its symbolic usages, the Veda and related ancient religio-philosophical scriptures are full of this kind of complexity and interdeterminability of intention. Indeterminability of intention. In order to clarify this and understand the Vedic testimony properly, Nyaya recommends that one study the Mimamsa philosophy because it provides systematized rules and interpretations for studying the real meaning of the Veda. So here is Nyaya is one philosophy, but it's recommending you study this other philosophy to actually understand how to interpret the words. Right? He's not saying you study that philosophy to come up with their conclusions. But to, in other words, Mimamsa very clearly then defines how you understand what's the context of a literature. Right? What is its predominant points? What is it actually trying to say? Right? So that has been done by Mimamsa. Right? So in Mimamsa we mean Vedant. Kara Mimamsa. We just say means in other words, you have to know the context. If you're saying you should study Mimamsa to get an understanding of this, then that means the meaning here, Mimamsa means Karma Mimamsa. Because otherwise we're saying you get an understanding of the variety of Vedic philosophical concepts, you should study Mimamsa. So there, Mimamsa means the topic of philosophical interpretation of a verse, the hermeneutics. Right? But if we're saying here, Mimamsa, we don't mean hermeneutics. We mean Purva Mimamsa. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But.
If
he came. He saw. He said, but.
If you want to means karma mimamsa, but that's not the real meaning of the Veda.
As a conclusion in philosophy, but their processes for understanding, it's just like this. You have a carpenter, okay? Carpenter, right? And then, so he knows how to take pieces of wood and nails and that and build a house, right? Now, does he necessarily know the actual proper use of a house to be used in God consciousness to, you know, make yourself and your family God conscious?
No.
But does he know how to build a house?
Yes.
Okay. So the Purva Mimamsa, they know how to analyze what is important in the scripture. What is it talking about? But they don't necessarily know how to apply that properly in their life. You know what I'm saying? So they can understand, okay, this scripture is talking about devotion to Vishnu. Right? But since they don't actually understand devotion to Vishnu, they won't know how to use that. But they can define what it is. Just like Nyaya, as a system, it can perfectly define the words, what you're saying, how you're saying it, if what you're saying is logical. Right? But where they miss the problem comes is that if this is used not for understanding God consciousness. So all these six philosophies have something very relevant in it. That's part of, basically, you could say, one philosophy, which is the understanding of service to Vishnu. But they get separated on their own and then get used on their own. Like in the yoga system, then all the aspects are used in bhakti. But if you separate them off from bhakti, then seemingly they take their own form. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? And then even in that, they separate things off and it seemingly becomes separate. Like you hear of Hatha Yoga, right? Then you think of the exercises and this and that. So somebody who's very expert at the various yoga postures for health and curing diseases. That's generally what a Hatha Yogi does, right? Maybe it makes their mind peaceful. So it balances both the external and the internal health, right? But it's nothing spiritual. So there's no meditation on the Supreme, anything like that. Right? Does that make sense? So Raja Yoga, they control the senses and all these things. Like that, pranayama is included. all that. So there's more of that. But it's not unless it's Astanga that it does the whole system and gets up through meditation on Paramatma. Right? But even that is still not forming bhakti. So it has the processes that you get through to samadhi that you're fully absorbed. Therefore, you take up the very determined service to the Lord. Right? But they don't start the bhakti process till after they've perfected samadhi. Well, on devotional service, you're going through those eight stages, but you're already meditating on Vishnu. Does that make sense? So that meditation upon Vishnu then is going there, and then when you come to the perfection of samadhi, you're already on the platform of bhav sadhana. So you're already in your spiritual form, already doing service, but now it comes to the point where the commitment to the service is complete. Right? While these others, that's where they start. You know what I'm saying? They'll start sadhana bhakti from there. Right? It'll be easy for them. They're not conditioned. But still, they're starting from where? Well, the devotee is already way, way past that. He's already in the Lord's pastimes. Yes? No? What do you think? Maybe. Yes?
But one of the six is recommending another one of the six philosophies shows that they work together as a complete unit, not
yes.
separated.
Yes, that's what it's supposed to be done. But I think what happens with time, they became very independent of each other. And that, because generally if you're going to defeat, you know, use the philosophies, it means if you're establishing a hierarchy, I think we're going in the order that they are established in. But at the same time, each later one includes what's in the earlier one. And at the same time, it can defeat the earlier one. Like that. Okay, so therefore we have the intention has to be right. You have to know what is the context that somebody's speaking. And that's why going by words isn't enough. You have to understand the context. So if a word in your mind would mean one thing, then you ask, like there, you know, bring me a bat. So what do you mean by bat? You know? Because they might be meaning something else. So you have to see the intention. So if you don't know, ask. That's the whole point of a discussion, is you can ask. Right? It's not just supposed to be an emotional display of, vociferousness? Vociferosity? You know, just, you know, who can be more emotional and more, in greater outbursts and make more noise and flail their arms more. It's supposed to be, you know, a discussion to find out, to come to a conclusion. Right? Yes? Okay, then proximity, that the words are used in a way that it actually, they make sense to each other. Otherwise, if you make a statement now, and then so many other discussions, then you make another statement connected to that first one, by proximity, it won't have any connection. So it won't have any validity there. Because everyone will forget, what are you talking about? Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So that means that proximity has to be appreciated. Right? If it's done in such a way that it can be otherwise, great. But if it's not, you have to make it, you have to bring about the proximity. Right? Fitness is, means the words in the sentence, they actually match each other. They go together. Yes?
About the proximity, I mean, if you go through the scriptures, same points keep coming up again. Does that mean each time they're brought up, it's got to be reintroduced to make sure there's some connection made?
Generally, it will be put into the particular context of that particular presentation, because the same points are always coming up, but they'll be in the context of that particular subject matter. Like Ayurveda is talking about the Supreme Lord, but they'll talk about him in relationship to medicine. Dharmashastra is talking about the Supreme Lord, but how to relate to him or serve him through the social structure. Does that make sense? So each one will be, there's only so many points to be made, right? Basically, it's, I mean, of course, ultimately it's always remember Krishna and never forget him. Then you have the element of identifying as servant of the Lord, being inspired to serve the Lord, taking up that service, you know, and trying to perform that service in such a way that the Lord is satisfied with that service. Right? So that's basically what one's dealing with. Now there'll be so many details. So some of those details apply in a particular way in one scripture, or maybe another way, you know, I mean, maybe different between scriptures. But the principles that they're talking about, those are all the same. There won't be any difference there. Does that make sense? Yes? No? And then the element of expectancy, how each word is dependent upon the other for its meaning. Right? In other words, the sentence shouldn't be lacking words that you expect to be there. That, in other words, you make a statement, you use a word, it should be complete and complete. So therefore, if it stands on its own, nice. If it doesn't, it has to have the other words that are going to make it up. Right? To make it completely in what we were saying. Right. So what is it? Diddy, ditchy, nappy? Or snoozy? I'm not sure that... You know Italian, right? No?
We can ask Rama or the Prabhupada.
Oh, okay. Okay? In other words, the word is going to have words that connect with it. And those words, those groups of word or groups of words are going to be connected to each other. Right? Until it expresses what it is you want to express. Right? It has that completeness to be able to express. No? Otherwise, then something's missing. So the expectancy is not complete. Okay? Nature of the physical world. As mentioned previously, the Naya system groups all the objects of the world into 12 major categories. Soul, body, senses, objects of the senses, cognition, buddhi, mind, manas, activity, mental modifications, rebirth, feelings, suffering, and absolute freedom from all suffering. Not all these objects of knowledge are found in the physical world, because the physical world is composed only of the four gross elements, earth, water, fire, and air. Although the soul and the mind are involved in the physical world, they are not physical elements. Likewise, time and space are completely non-material, but they nonetheless belong to the physical world. Akash, space or ether, is considered to be a physical substance, but it is not considered to be a productive cause of anything. In fact, the ultimate constituents of earth, air, fire, and water are eternal and unchanging atoms. Ether and time and space are also eternal and infinite substances, each being one single whole. All in all, the Nyaya theory of the physical world is very similar to that of the Vaisheshika school. And a more detailed discussion of this view of the world will be provided in the next chapter. Right? In other words, it's taking all the things, all these elements, they themselves are eternal principles. Right? Like that. But they may have temporary manifestations. But he's not worrying about it that they're atoms or not. He's worrying about just the position, because he's trying to establish truth. Right? So therefore, he will take all these, in other words, all these things have their position. They all stay. So that's why then they have some influence or some... influence some position or some consideration when you're discussing the physical world. Because the physical world, even though we would take it as the gross, it's based on the subtle. Right? Unless you think something, it won't actually manifest. Right? Unless intelligence is used, the senses can't be used properly. Does that make sense? If there's no space, where does all the physical stuff that you want to work with, where does it go? What is accommodating it? Right? Just the ability to accommodate something is a potency. Isn't it? One may consider, no, what's that? That's another thing. It's just there. But it's not just there. You want a house. If there's a small house or there's a big house, what's the difference in price?
The big house costs more.
So what is being offered to get the bigger house?
More facility?
No, I mean not what you get, what you have to offer to get it.
More
more money. So the money is energy. It's Shakti. So you're exchanging energy for energy. Right? That's how it works. If you want something of one value, you have to give something of equal value. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. You have, you know, three pieces of cheese and you want the guys next to you pakoras. Then you have to work out something that's equal, right? Like that. So, in other words, it has to be equal in energy. So that means if you are paying because this, it holds more, so that means there's energy there. So then why isn't there energy everywhere else? Just because you can't barter with it so much doesn't mean that it's not how everything works. Right? Yes? No? Okay. So therefore, their school is very similar to the Vaisheshika in this concept of the physical world, but at the same time it doesn't get to that detail because that's not their purpose. Their purpose is simply discussion through language to come to truth. Yes.
Do we consider this point that time is considered to be completely non-material? Sorry, space completely non-material.
On one level, yes. On another level, no. Ether is one of the elements within the Pradhan, but at the same time as the material world is accommodated in something that's not material. So how is that? So that means the all-accommodating potency then is actually the Lord's consort. And so, therefore, the consorts always have the transcendental form and the reflection is the material form. So the all-accommodating potency, therefore, then also has that. So there is the element of ether here that takes up the space here. But what it's based on is something greater. Right? That would be one. Or you're looking at it, that's being non-material. Time and space are non-material. Because time is actually Sudarshan, right? So time is movement. So then you could say that's not material, but at the same time, is within the material world is fixed by time. So that it, that is being fixed and it moves how it does, in the increments that it does. That only happens in the material world. The spiritual world, time is this means. It works to assist the pastimes. So it's not fixing them. It's assisting them. Right? Here you have to work around time. Their time works around the relationship. You know what I'm saying? You want to experience it for longer, therefore we see that Krishna's rasa dance goes for a night of Brahma. Right? So that's, you know, 4 billion years it goes for. But at the same time, it fits within the same night that everybody else is experiencing. Right? So physically, it's still only however much, 6 hours or that they have. But at the same time, the experience that they got was actually that of 4 billion years, not 6 hours. Right? Not bad. No. Okay. The concept of the individual soul. There are many apparently different concepts of the soul among the various schools of Indian philosophy. The Charvaka system states that the soul consists of the living physical body and its attributes. Sound familiar? I say most world religions work on that one.
What's
Charvaka? Charvaka. You never heard of Charvaka Muni? You'd like him. His philosophy is beg, borrow, or steal, but get ghee. Right? Because eating ghee, then you're happy. In other words, you're in this world. While you're here, make the best of it. Right? So if you're not eating good, how are you going to be happy? And eating good means ghee. Not bad, huh?
Not bad at all.
Okay. There are some shortcomings to his philosophy, but, you know, as this core principle, it has some. Yes.
Shloka goes like that. Yavat jire, sukam jire. As long as you live, you should live happily. Rinam kritva rutam kritvi. Even if you have to beg, make our debt, you know, still should eat ghee. Because vasmi bhuta sadehasya kutaraga vanubhavi. The body made of ash, you know, if you just turn into ash, so where is the next life? That was his philosophy.
Yeah, in other words, what's going to be next life? It's gone. So therefore, in this life, get ghee and enjoy yourself.
It's a little depressing, huh?
A little depressing. Depends. When you're sitting and eating the rice with the ghee, then I guess it's not so depressing.
5 seconds
before you die.
A lot of ghee?
Huh?
Yeah. I mean, always these philosophies have a little bit of a drawback somewhere. So this one also has some. According to Buddhist philosophy, there is no soul. Right? So they work on the a-soul philosophy. Right? Buddhism teaches that the stream of ever-changing thoughts and feelings is the ultimate reality. Right? This is the... we're just coming up with that. Yeah, like that. It's one of the... what's it called? It's one of the Neo-Confucianist philosophies. It has two parts. One is that... What we talk about is that there's the original... concept of something, you know, what makes its nature, inherent nature, then there is the physical form of it. Right? So if you understand the inherent nature, then everything will work harmoniously. It's from a lack of understanding that there's problems. Right? Then opposed to that is one, is it's not all that, it's just mind. All there is mind. So the nature of things and everything else is already included in the mind. So therefore, you know, it's the mind that's doing everything. Everything else is included in that. Problem is it doesn't then, it takes the mind as supreme. Right? The other one is taking Brahman as supreme. So it's a better aspect, but still is not complete. So all these are not complete.
So that's why they meditate on nothing.
They meditate on nothing, the moo. Right? That's not a cow moo. That's a moo. That's not a... It's not a moo-moo, it's just moo. Right? Because moo-moo is with a double O, and moo is just with a single U. Moo. Moo, nothing. In the Buddhist philosophy, then you're trying to come to the state of moo, nothingness.
So they think that if you can concentrate on... Moo, long enough, you will become moo.
Moo, yes. But the problem is you have to think to be in moo. So then if you become moo, then you won't be thinking. So therefore, you won't be conscious that you're in the state of moo. So what's the use? You know what I'm saying? It'd be like if you were, you know, you wanted to live in a big palace and that would be great and that would be perfect. But in getting into the palace, then you're in a coma. Then what is the meaning? Right? So in the same way is that supposedly they're absorbed in this nothingness, but because they're not conscious, therefore how are they going to appreciate that they're in the state of nothingness? You know what I'm saying? Because you have to exist to appreciate. Right? So also in the Western philosophy you get this idealism, is that everything's ideas, so it's just the mind. So what the mind is perceiving and thinking and all that, that's all there is. Everything else doesn't actually exist. You know, so it's a very common, it's one of the common misconceptions. Does that make sense? Like that. You just have various forms of it, but it's the same thing. Right? Yes? Okay, just like you have, yes?
So the major difference would be between Buddhism and Charvaka is that Buddhists, they go for Mu, and Charvaka goes for Momo. That the Chinese also, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But made with ghee. Yeah. Yes. True. Okay. Buddhism teaches that the stream of ever-changing thoughts and feelings is the ultimate reality. This may be termed soul, but it is not considered to be a permanent entity, as is maintained by other philosophies. In other words, you can call that the soul, because it's what you're aware of, but the problem is how are you aware of it? How are you, if it's just a flow of what is it, thoughts, ever-changing thoughts and feelings, but what is the origin of that? And even if you become part of that, that still, what's the origin? What makes it flow? You know what I'm saying? So these are problems in the philosophy that they don't deal with that. But the main point is that the individuality of the soul is a major. In other words, you start with the physical, the potency of words. You have to be able to establish authority, right? Then the topics that you're going to be dealing with, you know, you'll be, one of them is going to be the nature of the world, right? And the other one's going to be the soul, right? What were the five things that Upanishads discuss?
The material energy, the soul, God, the relationship, and the process to get to the ultimate end.
Okay, and then what about the ultimate end?
And what happens in the ultimate end? Plus negative one.
The relationship between the Lord, the living entity, and the material world, that's not a separate category. Each one of those and how they relate to each other.
Oh, okay.
Right? You describe the material world and its relationship with the living entities and God. You discuss the soul, its relationship with God and the material energy, and the relationship between God and the souls and material energy. Okay? Then the process, then the goal. Yes?
Then
goal. Yeah, it means in other words, when the soul performs that process of elevation and they become to the perfection, what is the relationship with the Supreme once that happens? Like that. So you understand what we're going through here now in Shabda, the authority we're going through, then the words themselves, how do you establish that what is being said by Shabda and that is proper? In other words, where is the source of that knowledge and how it's actually understood and applied, right? Then the nature of the physical world, in other words, the 12 topics that are there, and then the concept of the soul. Okay.
These five topics from Gita, has any relationship directly to these things? That Ishvara, Jiva, Prakriti, Kala, and Karma. Kala and Karma instead of those two. Because that is just same. Ishvara, Jiva, Prakriti is same.
Mm-hmm.
Kala and Karma is there, those two.
You could say in one sense, because kala will mean time, which is effort or activity, and karma will be result. So now, because you're looking at that from the position of the material world, then the time, material time and material result are temporary. So they're going to go away. But they're replaced by devotional process and spiritual result. Yes, that's what we mean, is that all topics are dealing with the same subject, but from a different perspective. So it appears to be completely different because the detail may be different. Because if we say karma and we say the ultimate goal of life, because the point is this ultimate goal of life means the result of an activity to please Krishna. So in the material world, we perform activity, but we're not trying to please Krishna. Therefore, it's called karma. You know what I'm saying? You know, so in the place of prema, then that's replaced with lust. And then that is the drive for the material activities that give the material results. But if you have prema, then that's the drive for performing devotional activities that give a result that pleases Krishna. You understand? So everything works in the same pattern. Just the difference is that the application of it, then it will be according to what works in that, to enhance that topic. Through that topic, one can understand the Lord. But otherwise, the same things. Yeah? Okay. Yes? No? According to the concept of soul held by the Nyaya and Vaisheshika systems, the soul is a unique substance of which all desires, avaritions, pleasures, pains, and cognition are qualities. There are different souls and different bodies. The soul is indestructible and eternal, and its attribute is consciousness. Because it is not limited by time and space, the soul is also seen as infinite or all-pervading. There are many souls, and because one person's experiences do not overlap those from another person, one's experience is completely distinct from any other's. Right? So then in Nyaya and Vaisheshika, they accept the actual individuality of the soul, and that it's eternal, and that it has so many natural qualities that it has. And each soul's experience is unique and different from another's. So anything missing in this description?
It's a relationship with God?
Yes, it's a relationship with God. Right? You understand? So, therefore, it's very nice. It explains this, and people will be very satisfied with this. But the problem is it doesn't explain the relationship with God. Right? At least at this point, it's not. So there'll be a weakness in the philosophy. So you can see is that it has elements. That's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying, that no thought is bad in itself. Right? It's a matter of its proper understanding, its application, and everything. So all these different philosophies and that, you'll see there's something in it that's useful as a starting point. But the problem is they misunderstand what they're dealing with. And, you know, therefore, in ignorance, they come up with the wrong conclusions. Does that make sense? Nyaya gives numerous arguments to prove the existence of the soul. It first argues that the body is not the soul because immaterial consciousness can be said to be an attribute of the cannot be said to be an attribute of the material body, right? You can't have immaterial consciousness that's generated from the material body. So in other words, they won't support the theory that the material energy is generating the consciousness. Which, does that make sense? At least at this point. And not at least on the gross level. Let's see if they get stuck on the subtle level. Material body, which is in itself unconscious and unintelligent. Neither can the functioning of the senses explain the process of imagination, memory, and ideation. Ideation,
none of these.
Okay. Not sure what the gap is there. None of these functions depends on any external sense. Right? In other words, imagination and memory, right, are not based on the functions of the senses. The mind can also not be the soul because the mind is considered to be an imperceptible substance. Nor can the soul, as the Buddhists maintain, be identified as the ever-changing series of cognition. The soul cannot be said to be an eternal and self-effulgent consciousness because consciousness cannot subsist without a certain locus. At the same time, the soul is not mere consciousness or knowledge, but is the knower of knowledge and the enjoyer of objects. In sum, the soul is not consciousness, but is a substance having consciousness as its attribute. Right? Yes.
What does locus mean?
Locus. Locus means like place? Or
place.
Place. You know, sometimes in the, especially in the Midwest or stuff like that, then these huge clouds of, you know, big like grasshoppers come in. Like they're small, they're grasshoppers, but if they're big, they're locusts. Right? So therefore, without a specific locus, then there cannot be consciousness. So that means out of that big, big cloud of all those bugs, one of the bug is conscious. And all the other bugs are simply, what is it? Moving in the ever-changing series of cognition. So if you catch that bug, all the rest of them will disappear. Yes. And maybe they'll let you know what's happening. What do you think? Think we could sell this to the farmers of the Midwest?
No, I'll go shoot
you. Okay.
It says, and the enjoyed of objects.
And the enjoyed.
The knower of knowledge and the enjoyed of objects.
It's probably supposed to be enjoyer. But even if you're technically, if you're the enjoyed of objects, because we think we're the enjoyer, but it's the objects that are the enjoyer.
And the rest of you
would think. Yeah. So you could look at it either way, whichever way it's spelled. But enjoyer would be more obvious, and people would catch it more easily. And enjoyed means they'd have to understand a little bit more technical philosophy to appreciate. Okay, now, what is the problem in this statement, then? Because they're saying it's not made of consciousness. It has to be more than that because it has consciousness.
The soul is indestructible and eternal. And here it says that it's not eternal.
Mm-hmm. No, it cannot be said to be an eternal and self-effulgent consciousness.
Yeah.
Because consciousness cannot subsist without a certain, origin or place.
It's not just consciousness.
Yeah, because otherwise we say, is there's Krishna conscious? You have to become conscious like that. So why would this be not complete?
Make a distinction between the beginning and consciousness.
Yes.
Yes.
Soul
and the mind, basically.
Soul and mind, but consciousness is also beyond the mind in one sense. But then, so what is missing here? Why are they saying there's more beyond, but they don't say what's more beyond? Right? They've mentioned one thing. They've mentioned eternity. Now they're mentioning consciousness.
Bliss.
Bliss, right? So, in other words, the soul is consciousness, but it's not exclusively consciousness. It's Satchit and Ananda. Right? So consciousness inherent in the soul means it's non-different. Consciousness is non-different from the soul. But at the same time, the soul is not just consciousness. Because from Sat, eternity, then comes our form, our relationships, you know, all these different things. And from Ananda comes the experiences that we gain, you know, so that stream of consciousness. Like that. But then Chit, then that consciousness also means knowledge, by which then the relationship and the happiness are connected. Because here they're saying knowledge. But is the knower and the enjoyer of objects. Right? So knowing is your sambandha and the enjoyer is your prayojana. So the consciousness has to be in the middle to connect those. So they're trying to say is that it's bigger, but they don't understand how it's bigger.
They're saying everything,
They're saying everything, but they're not connecting it. That's always the problem when you're dealing with a mundane concept, is that they're going to many times say all the things, but they won't connect them. Right? So that's why one has to, one, come to the Vedic version, because you're sure it will have all the elements. But then it's only if it's coming in the bona fide line, then it will actually connect everything together properly. Otherwise, it may miss stuff. Yes? No?
Are they saying, Maharaj, that the soul is consciousness or the soul?
No, they're saying the soul is conscious. They're trying to, because the Buddhists are saying it's simply consciousness. And it's not even individual consciousness. There's this stream of consciousness. And because of your illusion, you're a part of that. But as soon as you understand that you're not part of that, then you disconnect from that, and then you don't exist, and therefore you'll be happy. You understand? Doesn't make much sense, but hey, you know, whoever said, you know, sitting, you know, in a lotus position staring at a wall for 7 hours makes any sense either. You know, so. But they do make nice gardens.
Teach good kung fu also.
Yeah.
And a nice culture.
Yeah. But then one is theirs, but that's the Buddhists. The Taoists aren't much different. Okay. So then we'll stop here and then continue on Wednesday. Oh, they do have a concept of God. So liberation is what you get to, the concept of God, and then it's the end. So they actually have dealt with all of them. God, liberation, individual soul, the physical world, and the potency of words. Yeah, because their whole process is nyaya, so therefore that's their process. So the process, so they think the soul is individual, is in possession of consciousness and is eternal. They don't understand relationship, at least at this point, with Godhead. Material world exists, but it's made up of elements that are eternal. So therefore, you have to understand their relationship from that. Then God, we haven't gotten to. We'll get to. And then the material. We've done the material. Then your process is nyaya. And then they'll get to. And then liberation is their goal. Understand? So all five is being discussed. It's just a matter of what they actually get to. Okay. Oops. Looks like a baby June bug. It's only this big, so does that mean next June will be this big? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jayanitai Gaura Premanandi.